We're doing Miguel's Esther with the Magen Midivna, and we're up to where Achashverosh got the harsh words back from Vashti, and so he asked his advisors, "What should I do?" And Memuchan speaks up, and Memuchan says a peculiar sentence. He says, "She hasn't only sinned against you, but she sinned against all the officers and all the nations." Now, if you analyze what he said, so then it's the reverse from what logic would dictate. It's counterintuitive. It seems like he's mocking the king. Meaning, he's saying, I could forgive her, but she's what logic would dictate is, you could say a sentence that says, not only has she harmed everyone, she's even harmed you, the king. Okay, that makes sense. But to say she's not only harmed you, as though you're the small one, she's even harmed me and the next guy and the next guy. You guys are small next to the king. What's he saying? He says to the king, she hasn't only been disrespectful to you, she's even been disrespectful to everyone else. Well, isn't the king more important than everyone else? You're talking to the king. At least that's the way you should talk. So what's Memuchan saying? He seems to be saying, if she'd only be disrespectful to you, that would be all right. But it's not only your own personal issue. Now that's not logical. How can you say that to the king? The next question is, why is he giving him personal dating advice? He tells the king, remove her from the throne and give her kingdom to someone else. Give her royalty to someone else. Is that your job, to tell the king he should take a second wife? And the Megillah does not overtly mention what happened with Vashti. Doesn't tell us. Just says the king accepted Memuchan's advice. So what happened? Doesn't say. And Memuchan doesn't discuss what punishment she should get. He only says she wouldn't come before the king, so you have to punish her. Wasn't his whole point to have her killed? Why doesn't he actually spell that out? That's not spelled out. You guys, give me 1 second. I apologize. Heater's pointed directly at me. No, you could leave it on. The other guys probably want it. Leave it. It's okay. People have it on. Obviously, they want it. So the next point we have to wonder is, Chazal say that Memuchan, in the enumeration of advisors, Memuchan's name appears last. And Chazal say, here you see that a fool speaks up first. He was the least wise among the advisors, and yet he was the one to talk. Why? And why did everyone else remain silent? And even if he was so stupid, so why wasn't he punished? Why don't we find later on in the Megillah that Achashverosh paid him back? So, in order to understand what's really going on here, we have to understand that Memuchan was playing a game. Memuchan had to show that whatever he's doing now is to protect the king's honor. Now, in order to understand this, we have to give a slight introduction. Let's say you have a court case, and among the judges, you have a young judge who doesn't know too much, and you have older judges. And a person walks into court and says, Chaim hit me, Chaim cursed me. So if the young judge would jump up and say, oh, then we got to rule this way. So then that's really brazen. And then it could be that the other judges would kick him out. But what happens if, when the guy presents his case, the young judge would say, excuse me, sir, it's not right that over such a small case you're going to waste these senior judges' time. They're all senior judges. That's not their job to deal with such small fry. Let them go. Don't waste their time with this. And then he'd sit and judge the case. We could understand that he's coming out of respect for the others, but he's nonetheless going to end up judging the case. But then the judges might respect what he said and leave the case to him to judge. What's this similar to? There was once the baron of the city who wanted to marry off his daughter to a prized young man. But as it turned out, he was fooled. And he married his daughter off to someone who was not what he thought he was. And after a short time, when there was an argument between the son-in-law and the father-in-law, so the son-in-law got up and smacked his father-in-law. Smacks him once, smacks him twice. And the father-in-law is shocked. Here he's the most respected man in town, and his son-in-law did that. So he runs to court, and he goes before the city elders, and he says, I took a son-in-law, and now we had a disagreement. He smacked me. What punishment should he get? I want you guys to judge. How do you judge a person who smacked the most respected man in town? Don't you think he deserves a serious punishment? The judges are contemplating what they should answer. And among the judges, there's a young judge who really hated the son-in-law. He had it in for the son-in-law all along. So he thought to himself, if the judges judge the case as is now, so then the nature of things is that in a short time the father-in-law will forgive him. It is his daughter's husband. He can't give him too harsh a punishment for too long because it's his son-in-law. How could I ensure that he gets a bigger punishment? He stands up and he says, honor judges. Really, I'm the youngest. I shouldn't be talking in front of everyone. You're all smarter than me. But I think that the case has not been presented with accuracy. Is this really a case between the baron and this derelict? First of all, we have to analyze the case as though it weren't the baron. If there were any ordinary son-in-law who would get up and smack his father-in-law, first we have to ask ourselves, what would we tell that father-in-law? Get your daughter divorced from such a guy. What kind of guy smacks his father-in-law? It's not a question of you being such a respectable individual. First, let's just analyze the case by its own merits. And after that, we as the courts will have to judge what punishment he deserves for smacking one of the respectable people of the community. But first, there's the more basic question. What's a father-in-law to do when his son-in-law smacks him? What was he thinking? He figures, if I can sever the tie between the father-in-law and the son-in-law, then I could really give him whatever punishment the courts will want. So long as they're attached, so long as it's his son-in-law, even if we give him whatever punishment we want now, his father-in-law will forgive him, and then he won't really get the punishment. This is what Haman was thinking. Haman saw everyone's analyzing what to do. But the whole analysis revolves around what should we do with the Malka Vashti? What do we do with the Queen Vashti? So Haman stood up and said, why are you asking us to analyze such a case? Everyone knows that if someone rebels against the king, they deserve the death penalty. But Haman understood that if Ahasuerus is asking them the question, then that means that he still loves her. And what Ahasuerus is really asking is, can you guys find me a way out here? I know that she just did something that she really would get the death penalty for. So Ahasuerus turns to his advisors and says, gee, what should I do? Basically what he's saying is, I know I really should kill her, but what should I do? I don't want to kill her. What should I do? She's my wife. All the advisors realize that if Ahasuerus is asking them, he doesn't need them to tell her. He doesn't need them to say, give her the death penalty. And that's why the other advisors remained silent. They were all thinking, what should we do? She deserves the death penalty, but we can't say that. The Gemara in Megillah says that he asked the Sanhedrin, he asked the Jewish court, what do you guys say? And the Jewish court said, they convened and they said to one another, she deserves the death penalty, but tomorrow he'll be sober and he'll be upset at anyone who told him to kill his own wife. So we can't answer him. So they said, we don't know. Ever since we've been exiled, we haven't had the presence of mind to rule on such difficult cases. You got to ask someone else who hasn't been exiled all over the world. So Haman, well, he hated Vashti, and Haman wanted her dead. So Haman found a cunning way to speak up before the king. And he said to the king, he said, I beg forgiveness that I'm speaking up, but the question is not really a question simply between the king and Vashti. It's not that she's been a traitor towards you alone. Firstly, there's a question here that a wife has treated her husband unfairly. A wife has been unfaithful to her very husband. Her husband asks her, come to the meal, and the wife refuses. Not only does she refuse, she shames him publicly. What a chutzpah! A wife does that to a husband? That's extraordinary. And as Haman was getting all enthused, he says, before we deal with the question of how she spoke to the king, there's the question of what did this wife do to her husband? Everyone's going to say that in every other marriage, when a husband asks his wife to come to the table, she comes. And the king, when he's married, he doesn't wear the pants in the house. What was Haman trying to do? Just like that cunning judge in the case, in the story of the father-in-law and son-in-law. Haman realizes that if he wants Vashti dead, what he has to do is convince Achashverosh to divorce her, to sever his connection with her. And that's why Haman said, the first thing that has to happen here is a reaction within the relationship between you and her. And then, leave it to the judges to give her what punishment any woman would get for speaking with scorn towards the king. Haman's insistence was, when everyone hears the way your wife spoke to you, people are going to say he doesn't rule over his own wife. What does he rule over? It's a question of your relationship with her. You have to show that within your relationship, you're the boss. You have to divorce her. You do that right away while everyone's present at the tables, so then no one will walk home and tell his wife, his own wife tells him what to do. He's not the boss of anything. Everyone has to see that you divorce her right now. Everyone has to see that you stand up for your rights. What's Haman's thought? If I can get him to divorce her, and then we judge her like anyone who speaks disrespectfully to the king, then she's finished. Haman is making a claim that he's standing up for the king. He says, she hasn't only spoken against you, the king. What's he saying? Vashti has done an act that's unfaithful within a marriage. What she's done is something that's not reflective of you, the king. It's reflective of what any wife would do to her husband, and you have to react the way any husband would to his wife. Teach her a lesson, divorce her. And you have to do that today. That's what Haman was saying. Vayom hazeh, today. Word's going to spread that she did it, and everyone's going to say, you're not the boss. So today you have to divorce her. And that's why he said you have to publicize that you've divorced her and you're taking on a new wife. And that's the way you're going to show that you're boss in your own home. After that, you leave it to the judges to decide what will happen with her. And of course, the judges decide to kill her, but the Megillah doesn't have to specify that. All the Megillah has to say is that Ahasuerus said, Haman's right, everyone took up Haman's advice, and he divorced her. Haman says to Ahasuerus, if it finds favor in your eyes, then this should all be recorded in the public books. That when Vashti wouldn't come, you got rid of her, and you gave her throne to someone else. And the Medrash over here gives us a fantastic insight. The Medrash draws a correlation between the story of Esther and the story of Shaul HaMelech. Remember, Esther was a descendant of King Saul. Esther was from the tribe of Binyamin. And the Medrash says the same term that was used when the kingship was taken from King Saul, when God said, I will give the kingship to your friend who is better than you, who was that? David the Melech. That same term was used to give the throne to Esther. Haman says to Achashverosh, you will give the kingship of Vashti to her friend who is better than her. By Shaul it said, V'natna l'racha tov mimeka. By Vashti it says, Yiten ha-melech liruta ha-tova mimena. identical terms, only one's in the masculine, one's in the feminine. And the Medrash is teaching us a tremendous insight. We have to begin by asking a few questions. If a person has a difficult wife, and she's making his life bitter in every way she can, and you guys know the story about a guy who lost his wife? He had a fantastic wife. She was mamish tzadekes, and they had a great marriage. And then she passed away. And then the shadchanim come to him and they ask him, "We want to set you up. Who should we set you up with?" So the guy says, "Look, my first wife was the sweetest thing you could imagine, and I'm scared that I had such Gan Eden here on earth that I'm going to have nothing left in the world to come. So I want you to find me the most bitter, wretched human being you could find. I need to suffer a little bit in this world. Life was so sweet. I'm already getting old. I'm never going to have anything in the world to come if I get another sweet wife like that. You got to get me the worst person in the world." So all the shadchanim look at him and they say, "We don't deal with people like that. What do you mean? We have people we can say nice things about. We have people who are positive people. Well, we don't have girls like that." So the guy says, "Nope, I'm not going to marry a good person again. I need a portion in the world to come." So each time the shadchan comes and offers him someone, he does a little bit of research. He says, "No, I heard something positive. That's not it." Time and again, they can't set him up. No one can set him up. Finally, a shadchan finds a girl for him, and he does the research. Everyone tells him she's nasty, she's vicious, she's cruel, she's a witch, she's yelling. Everything he wants to hear, he hears about her. Okay, he's done his research, he hears all the information, he goes to the shadchan, he says, "Sounds fantastic, just what I'm looking for." Okay, great, fine. He goes, he gets married to her, believes the shadchan, and day number one, she's the sweetest thing that money could buy. Day number two, week number one, week number two, month goes by. After a month, he calls up the shadchan and he says, "I want to have a word with you." So calls up the shadchan, he meets with the shadchan. He says, "Look, I don't understand. You promised me she's a witch. Everyone said she was a witch. And I'll marry her. And she's even better than the first wife. I never had a better day in my life. What's going on here? What's wrong with you? How could you lie to me like that?" Shadchan says, "I'll tell you the truth. I did my own research. They told me she's a sadistic witch. I don't have any answers. You got to ask her." So he says to her, "Look, honey, it's not so nice. I don't know how to raise this topic, you know. I have a little question here." He's not sure what he's supposed to say. He says, "Look, when I looked into you, the information I got doesn't exactly match the way our married life looks. She looks at him and she says to him, "Honey, you wanted to get the world to come, didn't you? Not with me." So, back to our Megillah. If a person has a wife like that, okay, a person has a wife who's the Wicked Witch of the West, and he has an option, so we can understand that at some point he's going to get divorced. Because he's going to say, "Life is the worst thing in the world living with her. And I don't care if I never get married again. I don't care if I ever find anyone. But better live divorced than live alone and live the rest of my life without seeing another woman. But I can't live like this." But let's say a person had a wife who was nice, pleasant. There are areas where she gets him upset. And there are areas where she gets on his nerves. And it reaches a point where he decides, I want to get divorced. So he figures to himself, he wants a better marriage. He wants it better than it is right now. So you know what? An intelligent person looks around and sees, does such a thing exist? And by the way, 99.999% of the time it doesn't. All of marriage has these areas which get on your nerves and has the areas which are good and fun and pleasant. But a normal person, even if he's not so happy with his marriage, and even if there are areas where his marriage is really vexing and annoying and perplexing, but at the end of the day, he's not going to be so quick to get divorced. He's going to look around and ask himself, wait a second, is there anything better out there? You guys know the story. It's a joke, but it's a true story. There was a guy who... He was married, and he wasn't happy with the marriage. And after a number of years, he decides to get divorced. They get divorced, and a year or two later, they get remarried. So someone meets him in the street and says to him, I don't understand. Why'd you divorce her, and why'd you remarry her? So he says, when we were first married, it was rough. And, well, it was rough. It was very, very tough. So I couldn't handle it. That's it. I couldn't anymore. So we got divorced. But then I entered the market for a second wife, and I realized that as a second wife, she's actually pretty good. So I remarried her. Well, that's the way life works. It's a true story, by the way. Unfortunately, it's a true story. Other people tell the story with the name. I don't remember the name, thank God. But it's a famous person who said it. I think the guy, he's going to burn for that line. A period later, yeah. Sure he's going to burn. What kind of insult does that say about his wife? But at any rate, the intelligent person, even if things aren't perfect, he looks around and he asks himself, am I going to find a better partner in life? If he finds one, okay, so then he's going to start thinking again. But if not, he ain't going to be so quick to pull out. Why should he lose such a good asset? Because it's not perfect. So then the question is, what was Ahasuerus thinking when Haman tells him, you'll just get a better wife. You get rid of Vashti and you'll get someone better. Who told him he'd get someone better? Vashti, it seems, was a great wife aside from this one point. So he asks her to come to the party and she refuses. He should have at least spent time getting himself a mistress, doing something, finding someone who he wanted to live life with, and then divorce her. So the Medrash is coming to answer this together with another question. When you look at King Saul and David, so you see that Shaul sinned with one point. He didn't wipe out Amalek. And God took the kingdom from Shaul and gave it to David. And the question is, Shaul wasn't perfect, but he's like divorcing the first wife. Who's to say the second wife is going to be any better? Who's to say that David would be better? So what was God doing when God took the kingdom from Saul and gave it over to David? And the answer is that Hashem said, when I take the kingdom from Shaul, so then the next king is going to learn his lesson. He's going to say, there's no way I'm going to be like Shaul. When God tells me to do something, I'm going to do it exactly. Because he sees the punishment that Shaul got. And that's also the same thing that Ahasuerus was thinking. He says, when I get rid of Vashti, the next queen is going to know, she's going to learn her lesson, and she's going to be much better than Vashti. And that's why the Medrash equates the kingdom being taken from Vashti and given to Esther with the kingdom being taken from Shaul and given to David. And Chazal say that in this area, Ahasuerus was right. Why is it that Mordechai tells Esther, do not reveal your nation? Mordechai says, the man's nuts. He killed Vashti over a little squabble. If you tell him what nation you're from, then who knows, if he gets upset at you, he might kill all of us. At least you're in danger, you know, you're in danger of being married then, but you don't have to endanger all of us. Don't tell him what nation you're from. So you see that in that sense, Ahasuerus was right. Everyone lived in fear. We're up to what the Christians call the second chapter of the Megillah. And we meet up with the great savior of the Megillah, Mordechai. Yes?
So you said it to the brother, Ahasuerus, if you'll have concubines and then get divorced.
I'm saying a normal person makes sure he has a better option before he gets rid of what he has.
The question is that, I don't know how Tzadik quote unquote was Ahasuerus, but that would be against Shem,
to have a second wife?
No, to have concubines while he was married.
Really? Why? I don't think so. I don't think so. No. The pasuk tells us that Mordechai adopted his niece, his cousin, Esther, for she had no parents, and she was his adopted daughter. The Medrash says, "Ashrei shomrei mishpat oset tzedakah becholet." Praised are those who watch over justice and do kindness all the time. The Medrash says, "Who is that?" That's someone who raises an orphan in their home. Someone who adopts a child, so at every moment they're doing kindness. The Medrash asks a funny question. The Medrash says, you know what? Even the orphan, there are going to be moments when in his sleep, he rolls over and his blanket falls down. And at that moment, you're not giving him anything. You're not even giving him the blanket to cover, meaning there are moments when he's not benefiting from you as his adoptive parent. How is that a fulfillment of the verse, someone who's doing tzedakah at every moment? You're not. There are going to be moments when he's not benefiting from you. The Medrash says, we're talking about a situation where someone raises an orphan and he gives him to eat. And the fact that you give him to eat in your home, so that's a fulfillment of the verse. So that needs explanation. How did the Medrash answer the question? The Medrash says another interpretation is, this is talking about Mordechai, and he raised the orphan Esther in his home. So the question is, what's going on here? Why is this a better answer to the question? Aren't there moments when he's not doing kindness by raising Esther in his home? Weren't there moments when she wasn't benefiting from being in his home? What did the Medrash gain by giving this alternate answer? So in order to understand this, there's a phenomenal Gemara in Sukkah. The Gemara teaches us a positive thought, which also has some scary ramifications. The Gemara says that tzedakah is paid in accordance with the amount of kindness it produces. Meaning, imagine a person meets a pauper, but the guy is not so hungry. And he gives him a steak, and he gives him the best bread and wine, and he gives him a king's meal. But the guy wasn't so hungry. So then the Gemara says he did not do as big a mitzvah as someone else who gave dry rye bread to a poor man who was dying of hunger. You'll say, but he gave more. The Gemara says no. Tzedakah is gauged by its impact. Tzedakah is not only a question of what did you give, it's a question of what did they receive? What came out of what you gave? And that's why there's a special prayer we say that Hashem should help us, that our tzedakah should really benefit people the way it should. Meaning if I gave money to charity, but in the end, like some charities do, it was used to pay the secretary, it was used to pay for the water bills, for the coffee room, and then 5% went to the poor. So then you get 5% of your tzedakah. So the Gemara teaches us that tzedakah is gauged not based on what I gave, but based on what it produced. What's the bottom line? Now, that's why I say this is a fantastic concept. In a second, we'll see why. But we all see the scary ramifications. Now, if we say that you figure it based on the product, so imagine someone buys the poor child his tefillin. We had a person in our neighborhood that every year he'd buy a few pairs of tefillin for a few orphans. That was his tzedakah. He'd buy a few pairs of tefillin each year. Okay? Think about it. Isn't that a great mitzvah? Every day he's producing that this orphan is putting on tefillin thanks to him. Right. Assuming they'll put it on. If someone buys someone else a sefer, every time he learns in that sefer, that person gets a merit. So you see, we gauge things not only based on what you invested. What? I don't know exactly how that works, but it seems it works. That's what we learned in the Chafetz Chaim, Na'avat Chesed, two or three chapters ago, yeah. But that's why we say the best thing to do in someone's memory, dedicate some Sidurim to a shul, dedicate a Chumash to a shul. Those are things that constantly have dividend. So now let's go back to Mordechai. Mordechai raised Esther in his home. Esther saved the whole Jewish people. So if I have to gauge who did the greatest kindness by raising an orphan in their home, well, I don't think anyone can come close to Mordechai. He not only raised this orphan, he ensured that all the Jewish people would be saved. We said that when we have to gauge kindness, we gauge not only based on what did I give, but what is the product. The Gemara quotes the pasuk, Ohev tzedakah u'mishpat, chesed Hashem ala ha'aretz. He who loves kindness and justice, the kindness of God fills the earth. So the Gemara says, maybe you'll say whoever wants can jump in. That's why it says God's kindness is over those who fear Him. Meaning, who merits to have this kind of produce from His kindness? A God-fearing person. The Gemara seems to say that not everyone will get this. If you want this type of merit to have such great products, such dividend from your kindness, you have to be a God-fearing person. What's the connection? Why do I have to be a God-fearing person to merit the mitzvah of tzedakah? And here we'll pause for a second. I want to tell you a story Rav Lau said over Shabbos HaGadol approximately 14 years ago. Rav Meir Lau. Back then he was chief rabbi of Israel, and I happened to be at the Kotel Shabbos Shuvah, not Shabbos HaGadol, Shabbos Shuvah. And he was talking, I don't remember at what shul. So I went there to hear his Shabbos Shuvah drasha. And he quoted the following story. There was once a guy learning in yeshiva, and his father had a business. He didn't keep Shabbos. He didn't keep kosher. He didn't keep faithful to his wife. He didn't do anything that a good Jew is supposed to do. And the kid came to Israel and did tshuva, learned what a good Jew is supposed to do, started growing in his learning, got married, and continued learning and made ends meet in a meager way. And his father sends him a letter and he says, "Son, I want to have a portion of what you're doing out there in Israel. I'm going to send you a check every month and I want you to live well." So the son comes to his Rebbe and he says, "Rebbe, I got a big question. What am I supposed to do? My father, well, he works on Shabbos. My father, well, he doesn't eat kosher. I don't know if there's a mitzvah in the Torah that he keeps. And now, out of that lifestyle, he wants to send me a check every month. I can make ends meet without it. Why should I benefit from the money he sends me?" So the Rebbe looks at him and says, "So you're telling me your father doesn't keep kosher, right?" "Right." "Your father doesn't keep Shabbos, right?" "Right." "Your father, you can't think of a single mitzvah he does, right?" "Right." "So now he wants to do one mitzvah to support you and you're going to take that from him too?" "Of course you should take the money. At least give him that mitzvah."
"If it's money, it's money from Shabbat too.
Okay. So when it becomes relevant, a person can ask his local Orthodox rabbi. We don't give halachic ruling from stories.
But
the message of the story is important.
Came from weekday income.
Oh, so if it'll ever be relevant, the person has to ask a shayla. We don't give halachic ruling from stories. But we get moral message from stories.
There's nothing to stop the soul giving that money to
somebody. Fine. If we want to understand it, this can be understood based on Kuzari. In the Kuzari, the king asks the rabbi, he says to him, "Why is it the prophets were such giants? Why are they always talking about the basics? Don't steal from the poor, don't afflict the widows, don't afflict the orphans, don't steal other people's properties. Why aren't they talking about these highfalutin ideas? They have prophecy." And the rabbi says, "You know, you have a very good point. I'm embarrassed to tell you that you can't talk highfalutin ideas with people if they're stealing from the poor and they're stealing from the orphans and the widows. The prophet was on such a level, but the people weren't. And there's no way you could jump 10 steps and reach step number 10 when you haven't done step number 1. And this is a very important concept. You'll realize that the ascent to the altar was a ramp. It wasn't steps, because it's got to be slightly going up each time. But each time you have to have everything built up to there. A ramp is very steady in its incline. That's the way a person's growth in Torah is supposed to be. That's the way a person's growth in the service of Hashem has to be. The pasuk tells us, "Shimru mishpat." You have to watch over justice. You have to do what you have to do first, and only afterwards, asu tzedakah and chesed. Only then should you go beyond the call of duty. A person might say, "I want to jump to the top. Let me be the most pious Jew still today." Doesn't work that way. You can't jump 10 notches. You can't do a million chumras when you don't yet do the basic mitzvos. Whenever people come and ask me for chumras, I say, tell me, do you honor Shabbos the way you should? Do you enjoy Shabbos the way you should? The halachos that are halachos, the oraisa, the rabbanon, about fun things to do. Do you do those the way you should? Do you honor your parents the way you should? There are a million things that are pleasurable. Don't talk to me about chumras yet. Are you doing the 613 the way you should? Isn't that hard enough? Why are we looking to jump to chumras? Let's go do beyond the call of duty. What about the call of duty? Are we doing that? There's a fantastic gemara about Marukva. The Talmud tells us in Chulin that Marukva said about himself, I am like vinegar that comes out of wine. My father was wine and I am vinegar. My father was so pious that on a day that he would eat meat, for the rest of that day he wouldn't eat milk. He didn't wait, no 3 hours, no 6 hours, a whole day. Ate meat today, wouldn't drink milk that day. And I don't do that. So you ask yourself, Marukva, he's a tzaddik. He's one of the big rabbis of the Talmud. He's no glutton. Why couldn't he do it? Why couldn't he just do that? Wait a day. You got to eat milk products on the day you eat meat? What's the big deal? And the answer is that would be a fake. If Mar Ukva would do it, it wouldn't be real. Because in order to attain a certain level of piety, you have to build up to it. It's not just a question of, can I do it? So today I decide I can do it. Yeah, that's a fake. A level of piety is only befitting if you've built up to that level of piety. Then it makes sense. Then that's called piety. If a person's not fit for it, so then it's a joke. That's not what he's supposed to be doing. The Talmud is telling us, if you want to merit that high level of tzedakah, like Mordechai merited, that everything, all the Jewish people were saved because of his kindness. Well, some people adopt an orphan, and on their level they're doing an act of kindness. You want to merit the complete kindness, that it has limitless dividend like Mordechai did? Think about what Mordechai did. Other than Moshe Rabbeinu, it's very rare that you find a tzaddik like this. All the Jewish people owe their survival to him, because he adopted this orphan. His cousin took her in, brought her up, made her into the tzaddikus she was, brought her up well, obviously. Yeah, so that's what the Gemara is telling us. That's what the Medrash is telling us. A person who's a God-fearing person, a person who has built up to that level, that's the person who will also merit to that complete kindness. Yes, B'Tzalel.
So, I'm thinking about not to jump over steps. So whatever it is, we have this boy from when he comes to Israel on Taglit, and he works in a bar, works in a casino, or whatever, and he steals and he does drugs. So it will be a chumra for him to start to ask how he can perform kinds of acts of kindness It seems that from day to night he cannot achieve that. He doesn't give Shabbat, he doesn't give anything, not kosher, not anything. Can we gauge that a person can choose a certain mitzvah, to keep, or just one single mitzvah to keep and go with?
I think that that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about higher levels, the basic level of being a kind person. Quite the contrary, it says in Avos to Rabbi Nelson that people who walk into Torah after being decent human beings, then the Torah sticks to them; it works for them. People who walk into Torah and they're not decent human beings, well then the Torah will help them become decent human beings, but it's going to be very difficult. It's going to constantly be a rocky ride. It's going to be very hard for them. It's against their nature. It's going to be very tough. So yes, the Torah helps us become better people, but a person is supposed to work on being a good person even before he reaches the Torah. Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah. We had a whole thing on this 2 weeks ago. And that's a mitzvah. It's a biblical mitzvah. That's not a stringency. The Torah says, Lo tonu ish et amito. There's a biblical prohibition against saying a single word that will hurt someone. Biblical prohibition, just like turning on a light on Shabbos. Biblical. It's not rabbinic, it's not chassidut, it's an aveira. Lo saze. Lo tonu ish et amito. Do not afflict your fellow man. One word, one gesture that causes someone pain is a biblical prohibition. It's not chassidut. We're talking about levels of piety. We're talking about a person going beyond the call of duty. Adopting an orphan, it's beyond the call of duty. It says, yes.
So is that the answer for somebody that's maybe just coming into the fold, who is hasn't learned anything, that they should just derecherez, and that's the first step? Is that the first step on the ramp up to the altar?
I don't think that there's a one-size-fits-all. Okay. think a lot of it depends on where a person's coming from. It's definitely one of the basics. One of the basics is to be a decent human being.
So, if this person is a good human being and they had a great upbringing, they got their parents, what's the first step into Judaism, into the religion?
I think that's very individual. It depends on the surroundings, meaning the first step should be something that's not counterintuitive. It should be something that's easy, something that doesn't go against the person's grain. Let a person first enjoy a Shabbos meal. Let's not talk about shutting his cell phone on Shabbos. If a person is new to Judaism, so I would try to make the first step to be to participate in Shabbos meals. Let him go and see Jewish family life. Let him appreciate the beautiful aspects of Judaism. There are other things that are harder: to turn off his cell phone, not to be on Facebook, not to, you know. There are a lot of things that are going to be harder for him. I don't think that's the first thing a person should face.
Sometimes those things, they can affect us. Once there was a guy, he came to my room for Shabbat, and pitom, it was already Shabbat, and I saw his cell phone on top of my bed. What am I going to do? I need to sleep there. I cannot tell him, get out your mobile phone from there. I cannot tell him to do an avirah. So I was praying that, you know, someone will go there and take the cell phone. And Baal Hashem, when I went to sleep, Baal Hashem's phone was not there. The question is, sometimes you are in a religious environment, you're a religious person, you love people that want to know more about its own nation, but sometimes that can collide with our point now, they can collide with our system. How can we see that?
I have people who come to my house with their cell phones on Pesach. I won't tell you it's not challenging for my children. I won't tell you that when my children see guests coming on Shabbos with an umbrella, that doesn't leave me with a lot of things to explain. There are a lot of things that happen, like the guy who comes and he says, I knew I had to bring something that had an OU on it, so I brought pound cake, POUND. Didn't really happen, but at any rate, similar things happen. Okay, so you have to figure out how you do it. But the fact that it's going to be difficult on me does not mean that it can work for him to jump 10 steps. So maybe you have to find the right person in the right scenario where you could have someone.
I understand that can collab with all your household, but one thing, you know, you have muksa on actively moving muksa. Even if you touch it, it will start to turn it on. That's a whole different thing, because then it will, that's a machsor, what's called.
You don't think it affects the Pesach Seder when someone stands up in the middle of the Seder to answer his cell phone? You don't think it affects the Shabbos table when...
I'm not saying that doesn't affect.
So I'm saying that...
the entire household. But you don't need to pick up the phone to go to sleep. Or you can maybe tell him that maybe, you know...
You're assuming a guy doesn't come with crackers in his pocket to the Seder. Or bring a bag of bagels and say, back at home, we'd always have bagels at our Seder table. Right. You're assuming all kinds of things.
I didn't want to think about it.
Okay.
I was at a Shabbat table, I think it was like close to the Sukkot around that time. And I hadn't gotten a job, so I had to go to Chabad that was by me. And almost no one's from there. And I remember I was close to the rabbi. And at the end of the table was this one girl who had a jacket, and she took it off, and it was, I mean, it literally looks like she's wearing something from the beach, like spaghetti strap, and very low cut, and I knew I couldn't say anything, and I think I said something private the next day, but it was just, you know, those things are really hard, you know, when the first thing I was told is don't impose your views, and, you know, what can you say at that point?
Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. Look in your master. Look in your sitter. What's your business?
Yeah.
Just remember.
It affects the mood, though, I feel.
Of course it affects the mood. So go to a regular Orthodox home and remember that chances are, when you were starting out, you were also affecting the mood. That's the way we all start out. What can you do?
When I started out, I turned my cell phone off out of respect because I knew that was the way.
So you knew and other people don't know. I'm going to end off, being that we went off on this tangent. I want to tell you a fantastic story. The story goes, I don't know how many years ago. There was a rabbi who was sitting Shiva, and there were many rabbis who came to visit him. And as they're all visiting him, a woman walks in, and she's dressed in clothing that are far, far less than what we would call modest. She's covered head to toe, but she's wearing leather clothing that's to the point where you can't really tell. She's wearing very, very tight clothing where none of the men in the room are feeling very comfortable sitting there. And she walks in, and she comforts him, and she says the words of comfort, and she leaves. And the rabbi who was sitting Shiva said, "I want you guys to know that she is one of the most pious women that ever walked the face of the planet." So everyone sitting there wasn't exactly prepared for that line. And he said, "Let me tell you who that woman who just walked in is. She's a woman who grew up in a home where she didn't know too much about what being an Orthodox Jew is. And she got married, and her husband was in medical school in Midtown Chicago. And so they had an apartment in Midtown Chicago, or downtown Chicago, whatever. And she'd come to the apartment for Shabbos so that they could at least be together Shabbos, because of the rest of the week he was working crazy hours as an intern. And then they had a son, and he's still working crazy hours, and they're still spending Shabbos in that house, in that apartment in the city. And the child hits the age of 6 and 7, and she tells her husband, "Look, you have to be in the hospital on Shabbos. But our boy has to know what it means to be in shul on Shabbos. And you can't take him because you're doing the rounds. You have to be on the floor." So what she decided to do was, on Shabbos she would go to her father, who didn't know too much about Judaism either, but he knew that Shabbos morning you go to shul, and he would take the child to shul. So the rabbi said, "Look, she doesn't know too much about what being Jewish is. But what she does know, she adheres to, and not only adheres to, she gave up on the weekend being with her husband. It's not like she was driving over to be with her husband. How many of us would stand up to that test? To be willing to forgo being together with our spouse on Shabbos, because it's so important that our son should be educated to go to shul on Shabbos. So she doesn't know that the way she's dressing is not modest. You know what? If she doesn't know, then God isn't holding it against her. We all have our limitations. We all have the area where we don't know beyond that. And what we can realize is that what she does know, she does with such tremendous sincerity that we all can learn from that sincerity. So sometimes those of us who grew up Orthodox, or those of us who have learned more, can look at people who know less and feel like, oh, what a pity they don't know more. Yeah, it is a pity. And if we can find a way, like promoting Torah learning on the web, and even if you're not giving classes on the web, when you're on the web, you could put up links in Wikipedia and other places to get other people exposed to Torah learning. That's something which every person can do. You guys are going to have some free time on your hands coming up. If you want an easy mitzvah, it's an easy way to help people discover what their heritage is all about. But we should remember that we are gauged by God, not by our fellow man. It's not our job to gauge anyone. And sometimes, just like the stories we keep quoting in the Sefer Maaseiot, sometimes the people who, to our eyes, seem like they're very distant from us, well, they're not distant because they're below us, they're distant because they're way above us. It's not our job to gauge people, and if we do, we have to realize that there's a lot more to gauging a person than what meets the eye.